Tov, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. We have lots to do today. We have a lot to do. Does everybody have a source sheet? Yes, you have source sheets? Good. We are on topic number three. First two topics that we explored were Judaism and paganism, then Judaism and modern paganism, and now we're up to Judaism and Christianism or Christianity. There is a lot to discuss on this topic. There's 2,000 years of history, essentially. And we are going to start at the beginning. I've decided to break this into two, because next week what we're going to do is we're going to discuss the relationship between Judaism and Christianity post-Holocaust and beyond. A lot has shifted in time since the creation of Israel, Holocaust, Second Vatican. There's a lot that shifted. We probably will not get through everything on the source sheet today, but we'll get through hopefully a nice amount. So, let's start from the beginning. I told you about a class that I once took with Professor Yosef Yerushalmi, who was a great historian, a professor at Columbia, and before that at Harvard. And I took a class with him called Messianic Movements in Judaism. And one of the big topics that we discussed, can anybody guess what it was? Was Christianity. Okay, now this is interesting. If you think about this for a second, that doesn't really make sense. This was a class about Judaism. This was a class about Jewish history, Jewish intellectual history. Why would we study Christianity, which is another religion, in the context of a class about Jewish messianism? It just doesn't seem to fit. Okay, how it affected Judaism. Okay. Jesus was born and died as a Jew, so that's part of Jewish history. Say again? Okay, you know, it is another religion, it's just not a religion that we believe is value. And we're going to get to that question in halachic terminology. Do we believe Christianity is Avodah Zarah? That's for a later discussion. But right now, we have to go back to the beginning. Because if you go back to the beginning, if you try to understand who Jesus was, who the historical Jesus was, based on, we're going to actually read some of the New Testament today, and I have here the Jewish annotated New Testament. You probably won't find this at most shuls, but this is annotated, if I'm not mistaken, by two Jewish scholars, Amy Jill Levine and Mark Zvi Brettler. And what they do is they point out many rabbinic or biblical sources that, you know, whatever comes up in the New Testament is actually, you know, coming from rabbinic sources, is a response to rabbinic sources. In the end, you can't really understand the New Testament. Not that that's like our overarching goal to get, you know, really focus too much on this book, but one cannot really understand it without knowing Jewish sources. That's one of the key points. But what we're going to see here is try to understand who Jesus was, okay, as a human being. And what values he had, what he stood for. And that's going to be part one. Part two, as you see, if you go to part two, we're going to move on in history a little bit with Saul of Tarsus, Paul, a double agent. And then part three, which really is sort of connected to part four, can a dead human being be the Messiah? And then we're going to discuss some major theological differences between Judaism and Christianity. Finally, part five, which we really will continue with next week, is medieval codifiers on the status of Christianity moving into modern times. So what we're going to do is, you know, let's look at an actual text, okay? Let's look at the book of Matthew. And just to understand, the New Testament is compiled by followers of Jesus. They say end of the first century, 80 CE. What's happening then in Jewish history? Can anybody tell me? What's happening in the first century CE? The Korban in 70 CE. The Romans were controlled the area of Judea. They were brought in 63 BC. And they're there till the destruction. And what? Who's like the most important rabbinic figure of this period? Starting at the beginning of the century. Anybody? Okay, there's Rabbi Akiva, who's really post-destruction. It's after destruction. Rabban Gamliel is there. We have Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. But even a little bit earlier, who's the most important figure that we could think of? Right around 0 CE, Hillel HaZaken. Hillel and Shammai. Okay? Hillel and Shammai. So this is the time of the Mishnah, the earlier parts of the Mishnah. And just to just throwing out something, what was Hillel's most famous, you know, what did he say? V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. Yeah, and just remind me, what did Jesus, you know, say? Well, he said you should love your man as you... Okay, so it's interesting to think about the relationship between Hillel HaZaken and Jesus, because they were operating, Jesus afterwards, but they're operating in the same domain. Now, what... Yeah? Now, we think of Christianity, you know, the first thing that comes to mind in terms of theological beliefs in Christianity. Throw things out. What do you got?
The Trinity.
The Trinity, good.
That, I never understood that.
Okay, the Trinity, good. What else?
Virgin
Resurrection,
birth.
Virgin birth. What else?
And the clarity.
You're not supposed to have family relations, yeah. Original sin, yeah. Okay, so okay, but let's go back to what I'm going to make the case right now. I'm not the first person to make this. I mean, the historians, you know, including Professor Yerushalmi, is that, you know, before you get to the religion of Christianity and Catholicism, which develops over time, you have this guy Jesus who was let's just read what his values were, you know. Was he pro Torah law and halacha, or was he against it? I mean, the whole point, Christianity, what did Christianity abolish?
A halacha.
Christianity abolished halacha, right? The whole point is that you didn't have to get circumcised. You didn't have to do too much.
But that was
okay. So good. So let's look at Jesus himself, and obviously, you know, whether this is historically 100% accurate or not, we'll take these texts right now. We'll just read them for what they say. So this is the book of Matthew. This is chapter 5. This is Jesus speaking here. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commandments and teaches others accordingly would be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I will tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. If this guy gave a drasha on Shabbat morning, would you say he's a heretic? Would you boot him out of the synagogue? What would you say?
Sorry.
You say he's like really frum. I mean, he's, you know. Now notice the term Pharisee. What does it mean to be a Pharisee? Okay, so this is the rabbinic, these rabbinic leaders of this time. They were the ones who, I mean, as opposed to the Sadducees, the Sadducees who were in the temple, more temple focused, the priests, they believe that in the halakha was this tradition that, you know, which we believe in, that evolved over time, was passed down from Moshe Har Sinai. But Pharisee in Christian terminology has a very negative connotation. You know what it means, Pharisee? It means, yeah, it's like a hypocrite or a legalist, someone who's too focused on the details. Just look at this. It suggests that he sees the Pharisees as being something positive. You know, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees, right? So the meaning of the term. So Jesus is agreeing with this group of Pharisees, of Jewish, of rabbis, the leading rabbis of the time. And but let's go on a little bit further. You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, raka, I don't know what that means, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. This is the Beit HaMikdash, right? First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer. You may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you've paid the last penny. Would you boot out the guy from giving a drasha after saying this? What is he saying here? No? Like, you know, don't go to court. Try to resolve things outside of court. Right? This is reasonable. A little bit more of an emphasis on ben adam la chaverol, mitzvot, interpersonal things. This is chapter 5. Let's go on a little bit further. What's he say about adultery? You've heard it that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Okay, that's a strong statement. We don't believe that api halacha, but everyone agrees that a person's not supposed to, you know, intentionally try to think about, have these types of thoughts. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away, for it is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away, it's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Okay, this is getting a little bit more extreme. Okay. Okay. Correct. We don't talk about it as much. We even talk about it less, by the way, than our predecessors might have spoken about it. There is an emphasis on hell, kingdom of heaven a little bit. What I want to point out here is that he goes like a little bit more extreme about certain things, but ultimately he's upholding Jewish law. He is within the system. He's one of these guys like pushing the envelope a little bit, you know, emphasize this as opposed to that, But again, he's basically within the system.
So when you think of the meaning of lot chmod, it is, don't look lustfully.
Okay, so nachon, fair point as well. I just wouldn't say we wouldn't say that's as bad as adultery.
Okay.
But agreed. Again, he's a little bit, he takes us to a little bit more of an extreme. Okay? Now, there's a little bit of a focus on punishment, so let's get to that. So that was point number one. Point number two is that Jesus has a little bit of an eschatological ethic. He's a little bit more focused on, like, the end of time, times of Mashiach. Mashiach, ay. He composed that song, okay? So he's, you know, so, and I'll give you an example, okay? Just, I didn't put this in your source sheet, but if you look at Matthew chapter 6, Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. Okay, he says, no one can serve two masters. He says, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your span of life? And why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Essentially what he's saying here is, don't worry about the here and now. Focus on the future, the redemption which is coming. Don't worry about toil or about work, your clothing. He's focus on the future, the time of redemption. This is a key part of his ethic. At another point in time, in Matthew chapter 10, verse 23, he says, the Son of Man comes. This is taken from Sefer Yechezkel. Also, again, identical. He speaks about hell and kingdom of heaven and Mashiach a little bit. And that's, but again, nothing that you would say that is, wow, this guy's a heretic. This guy is, you know, another, really practicing another religion. You know, definitely not the case. Even what he says about, you know, he speaks about, again, he goes a little bit too far with issues of loving your enemies. Go to the bottom of page one. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Okay, he's saying love your enemies. I mean, this, you know, if someone said this in a drasha on Shabbos, you might say, hey, you know, maybe I could try to be a little bit nicer to the people at my Shabbat table who I argue about politics with. Maybe we should be more forgiving, you know, more accepting, you know. But not crazy. Nothing too crazy. That's radically out of the box. Okay, so that's a key point. These are a number of key points about who the historical Jesus was. Okay, now we get to. Get into his story a little bit more, because he is the first person in history, at least in Jewish history, to claim that he himself is Mashiach. Okay, and what? Well, this is where it gets a little bit, you know, foggy. Like, this is where it gets like complicated, because by the way, just one more piece. Is Jesus speaking to, who's his audience? Is he speaking to a non-Jewish or a Jewish audience? Entirely Jewish audience. He says in Matthew chapter 10, verse 5, go nowhere among the Gentiles, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He's speaking to Jews. This is, he again, squarely, you know, basically within the tent of, we'll call it Orthodox Pharisaic Judaism.
Reading from Matthew. Are these the words of Jesus or the words of Matthew?
So I'm not capable of really distinguishing between these things, but let's assume that Matthew was, you know
whatever is written here would be.
No. Let's assume that this is how he's painted in the book of Matthew. But even in the book of Matthew, he's painted as a Jew. He's painted as a little left-leaning, liberal-leaning, Ben Adam L'Chavero type, you know, rabbinic figure. That's how he's presented here. Okay? I think that's absolutely true. He's a little anti-establishment, you know that's sort of, you know, okay. Now then in chapter 21 of Matthew, this is when he rides to Jerusalem and he's on a donkey. This is sort of to fulfill the prophecy of Zechariah. Now remember, the Romans are the rulers at the time, right? So, it appears that there was some support amongst the Jewish community for his, you know, that they believe that he, you know, he said he was Mashiach, and there's nothing against the dogmas of Judaism to say that, hey, I'm Mashiach, right? There's nothing wrong with doing that. You might say the person's a little bit weird. There's even a syndrome that, anyone heard of, Jerusalem syndrome? Okay.
There's a whole mental hospital simply for that.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Okay.
My friend who used to work there.
Ah. So interesting. So there you go. Now, I'm going to read here what happens when he comes to the, when, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to read to you from the from a text here. Let me just pull this up. Chapter 5. Okay, so he's in Jerusalem at some point. The whole story according to this is that Judas Iscariot, you know, tells on him, and the Roman authorities, you know, put him into jail. You can imagine the Romans would not want this type of guy floating around, you know, causing trouble. But now here's what it says here. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor, in Book of Matthew, chapter 27. Okay. Okay, it's not on the page. This is part of his story. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews? I mean, are you the Messiah?" And Jesus said, "You say so." That's what he answered. "You say so." There's no, you know, yes, no, you know, there's no, and this is what he does, you know, every time that he's asked about this. But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he did not answer. Then Pontius Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many accusations they make against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge. So the governor was greatly amazed. So they then had to make a decision. They were going to crucify one of the people. By the way, crucifixion was how the Romans used to kill people. So they had to make a decision. It was between Jesus and this guy Barabbas. Okay, it was another thief. And this is where it gets... You know, there's this whole discussion what really happened here. Were the Jews the ones who sent Jesus to be killed? You know, from what I remember correctly, Professor Yerushalmi, he made the case that, you know, the Jews sort of called, you know, people in the crowd said, you know, kill, go and send Jesus to the, you know, to be crucified. His reading of this is that, is as follows, that they, you know, for people who believe that he was Mashiach, they wanted to bring it to the, let's make this happen. So if he's Mashiach, there's no way he's going to be killed. So, you know, this is Professor Yerushalmi's reading of this story. So it was a way to sort of bring forward the culmination of his messiahship, if you will. Anyway, the guy is, was that clear or did I know? Yeah.
Yeah. socioeconomic
factors. Yeah.
He went up to Yerushalayim, it was his Pesach.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And he was a rabble rouser. He threw over the table and a large block, and the Romans had no patience.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. They didn't want anyone.
And the Sanhedrin kind of were sort of not sure what they should do with this crazy guy.
Well, again, he's equivocating. Is he Messiah? Is he not? You know, he's self-proclaimed one, but then he's not really answering these questions. So you could see how he's a. Say again. What? No. In this story, he at one point earlier on he says, "I don't know where he says." Earlier on, he claims that he is. I could try to find a source. Let me see where it is in my notes. It's chapter 21. Let me just see if I could find this, but there's a chance that I might not be able to. Yeah, there's all this talk about him being it. While Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves and said to them on the way, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death." I guess he's speaking about himself here. I, to be honest, I'm not as well versed in this stuff as others might be. Bekitsur, he left this very unclear picture about whether he thought he was or he wasn't. He claimed he was, but then he didn't really quite answer to the authorities. So, Bekitsur, what's important is really what happens next. Oh, yeah. I was thinking it. Honestly, I was planning on showing some of it, but it's just too much work. You got everyone as homework, go home and watch The Life of Brian. It's such a great movie. Now, the key point is what happens after he's killed. Because after he's killed, most of his followers fall away. And he did have some followers who thought he was Mashiach. These were Jews who thought he was Mashiach. Okay? Most of his followers fall away. But for some people who felt so closely connected to him, it was impossible that he was Mashiach, that he died. Okay? So that's later. I'm not getting, you know, that's later folklore in the Christian tradition. Trying to uncover like who he was, you know, as it's playing out in 30 CE. Okay? And that's the key point that I'm trying to make, that Christianity as a religion evolves later on, after Jesus is dead. And that's a really key point. Because originally, Jesus was a Jew, again, this, you know, rabbinic type figure who claims he's Mashiach. That doesn't mean that he, you know, that doesn't add up to the Trinity. That doesn't add up to Christian theology as we know it today. That just adds up to this guy who thought he was Mashiach. And there have been other people who have thought they're Mashiach, and there have been other people who think that other people are Mashiach. So there's a tradition here within Judaism, if I may go so, yeah. He does appear in the Gemara in a few different points. Some of this stuff is censored, very interestingly, from the Gemara. I've not included that in the source sheets, but some other stuff I have. So let's look at, now, after he dies, his followers mostly fall away, but some of them feel that this is, we, you know, there's no turning back. You know, he must be the Messiah. This is, of course, how they come up with his notion that he's resurrected, that he comes back. It was impossible for them to imagine that he would that he had died, and their hopes were dashed. This also happens later on with another messianic figure by the name of Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, what does he do? Anybody know? 1660, he converts to Islam, and a bunch of his followers follow him to become Muslims because they can't imagine. It's impossible that he is not, and even after he died, even people who didn't become Muslims believe that he was still, was somehow Mashiach or something, or, you know, whatever it is. So this is, people can get very connected to ideas, and they're incapable of separating themselves from them, even when they defy logic, and then they have to justify them even more, and they get pulled into the pulled into the cult. Okay, you see this sometimes even with political figures. People will, ultimately justify, they will abide by a particular political figure that they love, and it doesn't matter what they do, they will always reinterpret this and say, no, they didn't do this, they didn't do that, when it's plain and clear they did this certain or said certain things. What?
It's not only ideas; it's the concept of heroic.
Correct. There's something. There's heroic. Something about heroic worship. And correct. But there's also that we don't. There's a very important piece of Musar here, that we think that we're purely logical and intellectual in terms of the ideas that we believe in, but the truth is that a lot more of it is emotion. Okay, and a lot more of it is about group identity. And about, this is who I associate with. This is who I feel connected to. And so we will, do somersaults to justify certain things, because we don't really want to resolve cognitive dissonance, and we don't want to have to, we renege on what we believed in the first place. And this is a very clear example of this. But the key is what happens afterwards, because there is a small group of followers that are committed, until the end, with Jesus. And the next moment, the next revolutionary moment, is with a guy named Paul of Tarsus. Okay, Saul of Tarsus, known as Paul. And what he does, he is the greatest. I'm not saying this in a way to denigrate another group. He's the greatest shaliach ever in history. Okay, because Saul of Tarsus, realized that the Judaism had a message for the pagan world. Remember, the most of the world is pagan at this time. And that if he could only just extract the parts of Judaism that would be meaningful to the pagan world and, remove all the other stuff, well, he has a great case to make to pagans, and paganism was already on its way out. So he travels around the Mediterranean world, preaching, Saul of Tarsus, that anyone can become. He preaches a universal, sort of a universal, de-halachicized form of Judaism. Okay, and
he believed that all pagans should believe in one God, but that the mitzvot was specifically for the chosen people, for the Jews.
Okay, so what Paul believed is a very big debate, and the key is though is that there are now two groups. There are still the Jews who follow Judaism but believe that Mashiach, that Jesus is Mashiach. And now suddenly there's this other group of Gentiles who are being exposed to Judaism a little bit. But they're not the same thing. Okay? They're not the same thing. And let's first talk about the Jews for a second, because we'll see that at certain points it became really unclear. Like, are you sort of part of us? Are you going to be members in our community? Are you starting a breakaway? What's going on? Because if you look at the Gemara, go to page 3, okay? Go to page 3, there's a Gemara source here from the Talmud Bavli. This is Masachet Brachot Daf Kavchet. Masachet Brachot Daf Kavchet. We have a story about the 19th bracha of the Amidah. Now, remember, the Shmon Esrei is called Shmon Esrei, but there's really 19 brachot. Which is the bracha that was added later on? Anybody know? Vila malshinim al tehi tikva. What does that mean? Well, what does it mean? Vila malshinim al tikva. Let's take out a siddur. Anybody? Okay, vila malshinim al tehi tikva. Informers. Who is this about, this bracha? I once gave a shiur about this. The history of Lamal Shanim and praying for the destruction of your enemies. It's an interesting notion, right? Okay, for the slanderers, let there be no hope. May all wickedness perish in an instant. May all your people's enemies swiftly be cut down. May you swiftly uproot, crush, cast down, and humble the arrogant swiftly in our days. Blessed are you, Lord, who destroys enemies and humbles the arrogant. Amen. Okay. So, pretty strongly worded blessing. It's a strong bracha, no doubt. Who is Why was this composed? Let's look at the Gemara. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis teach us, Shimon Apakuli, he's dear Shimona Esrei Bachol, Ithnei Rabban Gamliel, Al HaSeder B'Yavneh. Shimon Apakuli is a rabbinic sage, the post-Second Temple. He composed the 18 blessings before Rabban Gamliel in Yavneh. This is Yavneh, is, you know, the center of Torah learning after Yerushalayim. Amar lehem Rabban Gamliel HaChachamim. Rabban Gamliel says to the rabbis, Klum yesh adam sheyodea letaken birchat haminim. We need someone to compose the birchat haminim. Okay? Amad Shmuel HaKatan v'takana. Shmuel HaKatan gets up and he establishes it. So this guy Shmuel HaKatan is the one who composed this blessing. What was the origin of this blessing? So I'm reading now from a book called Who Was a Jew? By Professor Lawrence Schiffman. Professor Lawrence Schiffman is a Judaic studies scholar. If I'm not mistaken, he's still at New York University as well as Yeshiva University. He writes a lot about Second Temple period times. He's an Orthodox Jew. If I'm not mistaken, he lives in Great Neck, New York. Now, let's see what he says here. I'm reading from page 55. Now we have this term minim. What is a mean? What's a mean? Like a sort of a kofer, a heretic, a deviant. Now, since I'm reading from this book, since the term min can refer at different times to various forms of heresy that threatened rabbinic Judaism in Talmudic times, it is essential to clarify who the minim of this benediction are. Now, Palestinian texts of the 18 benedictions from the Cairo Geniza. Cairo Geniza was found by Salman Schechter, 1896, presented us with a text of the benediction which elucidates the identification of the minim. So earlier texts, there are many versions of this text, it's been censored by Christian censors in particular, there are different versions. What's the original text? And it says as follows, for the apostates, may there be no hope unless they return to your Torah. As for the notzrim and the minim, may they perish immediately. Speedily may they be erased from the book of life, and may they not be registered among the righteous. Blessed are you, O Lord, who subdues the wicked. While other specimens of the Palestinian liturgy show slight variation, the notzrim, usually translated Christians, and minim are included in the best texts of this benediction. Some may wish to debate whether the notzrim and minim here mentioned are to be taken as one group or two, yet the fact remains that the notzrim were included with apostates and heretics in the Geniza documents. Lawrence Schiffman continues, may we assume that this version of the benediction represents the text as it was recited by Shmuel HaKatan before the sages of Yavneh? On the one hand, the Palestinian liturgical material found in the Cairo Geniza generally preserves the traditions of Palestinian Jewry of the Amoraic period. On the other hand, there may be external evidence that this benediction was recited during the Tannaitic period, and that it included explicit reference to Notrim. Three passages in the Gospel of John mention the expulsion of Christians from the synagogue. Gospel of John was most probably not composed until at least this last decade of the first century. So there are these incidents of these are Jews who were mostly, you know, following Judaism, but they follow Jesus as well. They believe he's Mashiach, and they're still floating around. And what do you do? Can they be a chazan? Do they get an aliyah? Can they sponsor kiddush? You know, what do you do about these people? And here we have, sort of proof from the book of John that there were these incidents of people saying, you know, don't come to our synagogue anymore. But these people were still, they were sort of part of the Jewish community, on the boundaries of the Jewish community. But then, of course, we started speaking about Paul of Tarsus, that things, Saul of Tarsus, things really take a radical shift. Because what he does is he extracts the parts of Judaism that he believes will be palatable to a non-Jewish audience, and he removes circumcision, and he spiritualizes circumcision, and he says that that all we need to do is have faith, etc., etc. Now there is some very interesting discussion about the identity of Paul himself. Okay, let's go to the bottom of page 2. was Saul of Tarsus, Paul a double agent?
Now, I first heard a lecture about this with a professor by the name of John Gager from Princeton University.
And there's a fascinating shiur about this on Yutara. I have not had the chance to listen to it, but I would like to. And I put it here, Dr. Schneer Lyman. You see, if you just search in Google, Jewish Perspectives on Early Christianity, Toldot Yeshu, you'll find this lecture. Almost 3,000 people have listened to it, so it's a very popular lecture on Yutara. Now, there is a text called Toldot Yeshu, which is quoted by Rashi. Okay? Now, what is Toldot Yeshu? We'll talk about that in just a second, but let's look at this Rashi. This is from a website called Judaism... what's it called? It's Judaism.exchange.com, which is... I'm forgetting the name of the website. But, okay. This is what Rashi says. Bazui atame'od. You are scorned and ridiculed. This is referring to Edom. Edom is the continuation of Christianity, or the forerunner to Christianity. She'ein lahen lo ketav lo lashon. Okay, they don't have ketav, is writings, or language, their own language. Go to the next page. And this is the English translation. You are a lowly nation. They don't have their own script or language. Rashi goes on to explain the above text. Ketav ulashon. Acharim tiknu lahem kol sifrei ta'utam. Other people wrote all of their mistaken works. Yochanan, what's that word? Folus? Who is that? Paul's. Petro, Peter. Vehem, Yehudim hayu. They were Jews. So let's read in English. Others have given them Christians all their books of folly. John, Paul, Peter. And they were all Jews. Lashon, that is a Latin language that the bishops are fluent with. They, the apostles, mentioned them before, changed their language and created folly for them so that they would become a new nation in order to separate them from the Jews. Not because they abandoned their faith, only for the benefit of the Jewish people did they do it. According to this Rashi, Paul and Peter and all these guys were double agents. And what were they doing? They were intentionally making Christianity seemed very separate so that no one would get confused, because it was confusing. What's the difference between Judaism versus Judaism with a pro-Jesus, logo? You know, what's the difference between these things? And because there was this ambiguity and confusion, they said, okay, we're gonna act as double agents and transform this new group, to really pull them away from Jewish practice, and that's essentially how Christianity became as we know it today. Is this true? Was Saul of Tarsus really a double agent who was protecting Judaism as opposed to creating Christianity? So this is an interesting question. Gager, in the lecture that I heard, he says that, listen, Toldot Yeshu is it was circulating in rabbinic circles during this time. They used parody and satire to put a great distance between Judaism and Christianity. He says, nothing in Toldot Yeshu was made up fully, but everything is a touchstone in the Christian Gospels. These are from my notes from that lecture. The disciples created serious disturbances. All of these figures are, in fact, rabbinic double agents. Okay, in the book of Yeshu, that Rashi is quoting. They are recruited by the rabbis to bring about the final separation between the Jesus group and the Jews. They recruited Peter and Paul to bring about this. Once again, all of this is drawn from New Testament sources. Gager thinks, this is the key point, Gager thinks that the readers of the text in the second century must have read the New Testament and other letters, and in trying to make sense of it, thought that Paul was a double agent. He doesn't quite believe that Paul was really a double agent. Paul was doing his own thing. But people may have read these texts and thought, wait a second, what is it that this guy's trying to do? Maybe he's a double agent. This is how he, if I remember what he said in the lecture. But there is discussion about this in Jewish sources, and it's interesting to think about this, about the role of these people. Now, but the key point is that because of what Paul does, Judaism and Christianity really start to go their own ways. Okay, and over time, the next key figure is, anybody know who the next key figure is historically? Constantine in 329, 330, he convenes the Council of Nicaea, where Christian theology is clarified and documented, and the Trinity and the original sin, and he. So I don't know all the history, but it's at some point then they had to reconcile. Well, you know, Jesus sort of evolves from being just a messianic figure to now a godly figure, and so they had to figure that out. So they had to square the triangle. I don't know what the word, whatever. Correct, 100%. Well, it's more extreme, but also this is a very palatable, sort of form of, you didn't have to do very much, right? And Yerushalmi argues, there's a discussion about how is Paul so successful, okay? Yerushalmi argues in the course that I took that there was really two things. One, by removing, halacha from Judaism, it made it much more palatable. But the second thing he says is that Judaism has always been about a national identity, but being part of a group. And no Gentile would have felt comfortable in a Jewish setting. You have to like gefilte fish. You have to like kugel. You have to, you understand. But you have to like, I know. But you understand, Moroccan salmon, whatever. You have to, you have to like, feel connected to the people to Jews. And this is something that was never going to happen. Whereas what Paul did is he said, you don't really need to become part of this nation. You could just sort of be as you are, in your own communities. And so there was less.
I think it's very similar to the Roman.
Yeah. Yeah, correct. There were a lot of things were adapted, and correct. So this is a little bit of the early history, okay, and now we're going to move into some theological differences between Judaism and Christianity. Now let's first turn to the what I put as part three here under part two is really could be part of. Part four, but let's talk about this. Can a dead human being be the Messiah? Okay? Now, ironically, this is a discussion which some Jews are having today. Okay? Why are we having this today? Because, there's Chabad, and within Chabad, there are different factions within Chabad, and there's a debate about, the Rebbe being Mashiach or not, okay? Now, I remember I once had a bet with somebody. I lost the bet, and losing the bet meant that I had to go travel to 770 from Manhattan to Brooklyn, and I ended up going at like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, okay? Never been to 770 before. It was Adar Aleph. Okay, Adar Aleph, I walk in, we daven Marv, the guys are dancing, getting ready for Purim, okay? Adar Aleph, okay, it was like 40 days before Purim, and Adar Rishon, and something I noticed davening there is that there are pictures of the Rebbe plastered over every single inch of 770. It's a Beit Midrash and a Beit Knesset. I mean, you imagine this room filled with pictures of the Rebbe and his Mashiach and like you look around. I mean, and it's known 770 is sort of controlled by the more messianic faction of Chabad, and most people just look the other way because they want kosher food in Thailand, right? And we all want kosher food in Thailand or wherever else we might be. But there's one person whose name is Professor David Berger, Rabbi David Berger, who is he wrote a book about this. And he wrote a book. The name of the book is The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. Now, yeah. Now let me tell you about David Berger. David Berger, if you had to find probably the most, how shall I say, you know, just calm, matun, sort of thoughtful,
not brilliant,
non-activist type of person, that would be him. He's a scholar. He is not the type of guy who's waving the flag and, you know, sending messages all over Facebook and this and that. He is like, he's a scholar of Jewish studies. He's the head of Revel, the Jewish Studies Department at Yeshiva University. And he's a brilliant scholar. And let's just read from Wikipedia here what he says. And he's a scholar, by the way, of Jewish-Christian relations. Okay, and one of the arguments that he makes is that for 2,000 years, the main thrust of Jewish argument against Christianity is that once you die, you can't be Mashiach. So if people want to start believing that, you're undermining 2,000 years of Jewish polemics against Christianity, and you're sort of chalking up one, you know, for the side of the Christian side here in this debate. So who would like to read this? Who would like to read Berger? Karen, would you like to read? Go for it. Berger.
Berger, an academic expert on Jewish responses to Christianity, particularly claims of Jesus' messiahship and divinity, criticized what he viewed as similar assertions made by some religious leaders of the Chabad movement about Schneerson shortly after Schneerson's death in 1994 and even in 2014. Berger argues that the assertion a person could begin a messianic mission, die, and posthumously return to complete his mission has been unanimously rejected by the sages and Jewish polemicists for nearly 2,000 years. An example of Berger's proof text is the passage in the Talmud, which shows that Rabbi Akiva set aside his previous assertions of Shimon Bar Kokhba's presumed messiahship after Bar Kokhba was put to death. To Berger, the messianist viewpoint on this issue is outside the pale of accepted Orthodox Jewish belief. Berger has been highly disappointed by the Orthodox establishment's reaction to Chabad Lubavitch's claim that Schneerson is the Jewish messiah, arguing that there is a, quote, scandal of Orthodox indifference,
unquote. Okay. So, here you have a summary about this. You could go read the book if you want. And, you know, these are, Telushkin also writes about this in his book on the Rebbe. If I remember correctly, he plays down this issue. He doesn't think that this is, you know, something that should cause a schism or whatever it is, but listen, time will tell. As we just saw with Christianity, time will tell. We'll see where this goes to, how it evolves, and what happens in the future. Will it sort of die down, or will it get stronger over time? Now, what I want to turn to now is some major theological differences between Judaism and Christianity. We're on page 3. And we're going to look at a few pieces here. One by Shimshon Afalhirsch. If you look on page 4, another one by Rav Yitzchak, Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook. And then I've pasted parts of a very long article by Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik. It was an article called Redemption and the Power of Man in a journal called Azure, which is used to be published by the Tikva Center. Now, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik teaches at Yeshiva University today. He did his dissertation on Jewish-Christian relations. He's a grandson of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who was the brother of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. Okay, he's a very popular lecturer today in the Jewish world. Let's first look at Shimshon Afalhirsch on original sin. Who would like to read this piece? Marilyn, want to go for it?
One consideration seems to us most significant. The only curses
This is a story of Adam. Sorry, this is a story of Adam and Eve, and Christianity believes what is original sin? What does it mean?
It means that Eve sinned, and this is now
that we are born. That we are born into sin. Now, what I'm going to try to focus on right now between these three pieces is to show you that between the concept of original sin and the notion of what it means to be, what Mashiach is like, that we're going to see there are fundamental philosophical differences between Judaism and Christianity beyond technical theological differences. Okay? The whole worldview is shaped by some of these differences. So let's look at Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch, and then we'll look at Soloveitchik. Go for it.
The evidences contained in this divine judgment are directed at the brown and at one particular animal. God said, "I have created the brown and the one particular animal." God's sentence does not include a curse against man as such. There is not one syllable to suggest even the minutest change in man's lofty calling and in his ability to fulfill it. Only the external conditions in which he is to accomplish his mission have changed, and even this happened only for his own good. To this day, every newborn infant springs forth from the hand of God in the same state of purity as the infant. Every child comes into the world as pure as an angel. This is one of the basic concepts in the essence of Judaism and Jewish.
Every child comes in the world as pure and an angel. We're not already sinful as Christianity claims. Okay? But what a miserable lie has been concocted from this historical account, a lie that undermines all the moral future of mankind. We're not referring to the dogma of the original sin against which it is the duty of every Jew to protest against most vigorously with every fiber of his being. It is true that on account of the sin in the Garden of Eden, all of Adam's descendants have inherited the task of living in a world that no longer smiles at them as it once did. But this is only because the same sin is still being committed over and over again. But as for the doctrine that because of Adam's sin, all of mankind has become sinful, that man has lost his ability to be good and is compelled to go on sinning, and that man's return to God and the restoration of paradise on earth requires something other than a revival of devotion to duty and effort within capacity of every human being, these are notions against which Judaism must offer its categorical protest. Man needs no intermediary, dead or alive, to return to God. This is taught to us by all of Jewish history, which demonstrates that in subsequent generations, God came as close to men of purity as he did to the first man, Abraham, Moses, Isaiah, Jeremiah. Other alike them were able to win God's nearness simply by their pure striving and to remain faithful to their duty. Okay? And Rav Kook goes on further here and he says, listen, what do we learn from the sin of Adam and Chava? That is one instance of a person sinning. It's an example of people sinning. And like they sin and we learn about shame and they try to run away from their sin and, you know, how sin transforms their relationship with God. That's the message from that story. But it doesn't mean that the world is fundamentally changed as a result, or that human nature was changed as a result. It just means that that's a model for you sin. You know, you get into trouble, and there are consequences, and there's punishment, the repercussions, and then you need to, you know, clean up your mess afterwards. That's what Rav Kook says we learn from the story of Adam v'Chava. Now let's turn to this piece by Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, Redemption and the Power of Man. Okay? This is, you know, I've cut out most of the article. I've tried to include only the important parts. It's really some fascinating material that he has here. So let's read through this. Let's try to read through this together, and then we'll discuss. So who would like to start off? Can we, you know, maybe we'll just go, everyone read a paragraph. Okay. So Elaine, you want to start for Jews and Christians? No, you prefer not. Would you like to read for Jews and Christians? Try to read loudly if you can. Yeah.
But Jews and Christians famously disagree as to the identity of Messiah. Christians argue that Israel's messianic expectations were realized with the birth, life, and death of Jesus of Nazareth. Moreover, Christian doctrine asserts that Jesus was divine, God incarnate, and the second person of the divine Trinity. Jews not only argue that the Messiah has not yet appeared, but also disagree vehemently with the concept of incarnation. Jewish tradition has always insisted that the Messiah will be a human rather than divine redeemer, who restored the Davidic dynasty and defended Israel from its enemies. All too many Christians and Jews, however, assume that this is the only essential difference between Jewish and Christian eschatology.
Okay. Came and... Okay. So there are two differences so far. The Judaism says the Messiah has not come, and the Mashiach, when he does come, will be a human being. Christianity says, no, he already came, and
he's equivalent to, you know, to God or some aspect of God, whatever it is. So what Soloveitchik is trying to debunk is the notion that the only difference between Judaism and Christianity are these two things. People say, oh, the only difference between you and us is you didn't accept Jesus. What Soloveitchik wants to point out is that there are huge philosophical repercussions that beyond this, okay? Because the notion, how you understand Mashiach and the role of Mashiach in our religious life actually has huge repercussions for what it means to be a Jew and to be a Christian. And that's what we're going to look at right now. So let's keep reading. Okay, you're reading well. Go for it. Unless you want to go to the next?
Okay.
Yeah, who's next?
But I don't have a very strong voice.
Okay, keep going.
It's true that the question of the Messiah's arrival is one that will divide Christians until the end of days. Yet there is a more profound divide in the way Jews and Christians conceive the idea of the Messiah. The distinction relates not to whether he has already come, but rather to what part humanity plays in bringing about the Messianic redemption. A distinction that reveals very different approaches to the moral capacities of mankind. For Christians, redemption is essentially an act of divine grace, the salvation of a humanity that is incapable of saving itself. For Jews, however, the reverse is true. Redemption depends entirely on the repentance of man, who is responsible for his own fate. As such, the difference is the respective religion's approach to Messiah is, in truth, a difference in the understanding of man's own moral capacity and of nature of good and evil itself.
Okay, good. Let's one more paragraph. The difference between the Jewish and Christian approaches to the Messiah can now be clearly discerned. Jews contend that Rabbi Soloveitchik put it that the belief in Mashiach by definition means belief in our ability to become worthy of the Messiah. Christians, on the other hand, argue that belief in the Mashiach by definition means belief in our inability to become worthy of the Mashiach, in our needing the Messiah to take our sins upon himself. For Christians, the coming of the Messiah makes repentance possible. For Jews, repentance makes the Messiah possible. So here you have redemption is an act of grace. Man cannot redeem himself or repent because we're just weighed down in sin. So you need Jesus to come along to redeem us. Whereas we believe humans bring Mashiach when we are righteous. It's in our hands. Mashiach coming is conditioned on us. Now, you're seeing already two very different worldviews evolve. Which one of these is more pessimistic? Which one is more optimistic? This is much more pessimistic. Judaism is a lot more optimistic. Okay, and obviously, this, you know, we'll call this, by the way, this is, you know, essentially because of original sin, right? That, you know, you need Jesus to redeem you because man is incapable of redeeming himself. Okay, let's skip down. Let's. Correct. Correct. It is much correct. 100%. Let's go to page 5. Skip to page 5. Second paragraph. Okay. In light of the foregoing, this is really interesting now. Because let's say you believe that modernity, okay, has proven that human beings are actually pretty bad. Communism, fascism, Nazism, some pretty bad stuff going on in this generation, right? So maybe you want to make the case, look, what does that prove? What does that prove? 50 million people killed in World War II. What does that prove? That's proving the Christian side of things. Okay? Although it's interesting that the Nazis and the Catholic Church, which sort of helped to bring about World War II, you know, meaning all that stemmed from a civilization that had been rooted in Christianity. So that's an interesting, but that would seem to be, take yourself out of it, you know, whether they were Christians or not, that would seem to prove that they're right. Human beings are pretty bad, right? Look how much destruction we've wrought. Look how many people we've killed. Look how much of the environment we've destroyed and we're unwilling to do anything about. So Judaism, all this optimism, this is naive. So now we're going to address this question, okay? In light of the foregoing, One may anticipate the following objection. Does not so positive an attitude towards mankind's abilities lead inevitably to hubris, to the belief that man can achieve greatness without God's assistance at all? Has not the modern era been plagued by worldviews such as communism and fascism, ideologies that were based precisely on the belief in man's ability to recreate the world anew? This question was posed by Reinhold Niebuhr, one of the 20th century's most influential American theologians, and one of the most eloquent defenders of the concept of original sin. I don't know who this guy, I don't know so much about him. The only reason I know about him is that there's a person by the name of James Comey in the United States of America, who is the head of the FBI, who quotes Ronald Niebuhr all the time on his Facebook feed. Not that I follow his Facebook feed, but it sometimes comes up in the news. So, the utopian illusions and sentimental aberrations of modern liberal culture are really all derived from the basic error of negating the fact of original sin. This error continually betrays modern men to equate the goodness of men with the virtue of their various schemes for social justice and international peace. When these schemes fail of realization or are realized only after tragic conflicts, modern men either turn from utopianism to disillusionment and despair, or they seek to place the onus of their failure upon some particular social group, usually the Jews, which is why both modern liberalism and modern Marxism are always facing the alternatives of moral futility or moral fanaticism. Liberalism in its pure form, that is, pacifism, usually succumbs to the peril of futility. It will not act against evil until it is able to find the vantage point of guiltlessness from which to operate. This means that it cannot act at all. Sometimes it imagines that this inaction is a guiltlessness for which it has been seeking, etc., etc. There is, Niebuhr argues, this is Soloveitchik continuing, a danger in denying original sin and in taking a positive attitude towards humanity's redemptive potential. In other words, the Jewish approach to man can be misused. I've read enough, writes columnist John Derbyshire, to know what a stupendous debt our salvation owes to the Jews. At the same time, there are aspects of distinctly Jewish ways of thinking that I dislike very much. The world-perfecting idealism, for example, that is rooted in the most fundamental premise of Judaism, has, it seems to me, done great harm in the modern age. It's, again, an interesting point to make when it's Christians who have been the one. Okay, Jews were sort of part of the communism, but then, what happened to, what's his name? What was the main Jew who was killed?
Trotsky.
Yeah, Trotsky. He was... He was readily, very quickly removed from the communist movement. But the point is a powerful one, and therefore bears mentioning that Judaism never asserted that man is inherently good. In fact, God's observation in Genesis that the inclination of man's heart is evil from his youth has never been lost upon Jewish thinkers. Moreover, unlike Christianity, Judaism never understood Adam as being inherently good before a Christian's term of the fall. Rather, human beings were treated with the ability to determine their own fate, an ability undiminished by the events in Eden. The Jewish theologian Eliezer Berkowitz puts it rightly, Judaism disagrees with the Christian interpretation of human nature. Man is, of course, not good, but he's capable of goodness. He's a responsible creature. From the Jewish point of view, Christianity has not discovered an idea of God which is superior to the one taught by Judaism. Rather, it has adopted a radically pessimistic evaluation of human nature as compared with the critical optimism. I like that, critical optimism of Judaism concerning all creation. It is true that Judaism is fundamentally optimistic regarding humanity's moral capacity and that it rejects Christianity's thoroughly negative assessment of it. But this, as Berkowitz points out, a critical optimism. Man must have pride in what he can accomplish, but also humility regarding what he must learn in order to do so. It is for this reason that Judaism has always stressed the importance of law. Now we get to Torah, to halakha, as the medium through which man may improve himself. The Torah represents, on the one end, the idea that man is beholden to a divinely decreed morality. He cannot seek to redeem the world in whatever fashion he sees fit. On the other end, the very idea that man is obligated to a complex of laws, such as Torah, is itself indicative of God's faith in man's potential. Berkowitz writes, the law is a sign of God's confidence in man. Man can follow it, and the responsibility is his. If, as a result of original sin, man's nature is corrupt, if he can do no good by his own strength, then of course the rigor of the code of thou shalt is meaningless. There's no point in having laws if you believe that man's condemned to sin. If, however, as Judaism teaches, man has been equipped by the love of God with the potential for continuous moral and spiritual increase, then the law expresses the idea that God does consider and regard man. Okay? Finally, last paragraph. While most Jews rejected Paul's theology, it is all too often assumed that they did so solely because they rejected Jesus the Messiah. Such a view ignores the far more profound disagreement between the two faiths, a disagreement which persists to this day. The Jews rejected the Pauline view not merely because it conflicted with their view of the Messiah. Indeed, Jewish history is filled with disputes over proposed Messiahs. Disputes that did not really necessarily bring about the kind of rupture that separated Jews from Christians. Rather, the Jews rejected Christianity because Pauline theology contradicted everything they believed about the relationship between God and man, and about man's role in history. Evil, according to the Jews, cannot be blamed on a cosmic flaw or original sin, for that would deny man's moral capacity. The Messiah had yet to arrive, Judaism insisted, because man had yet to become worthy of his arrival. Okay? So this is it's a summary of this article. You could look at this other piece here, The Virtue of Hate, another article by Mayor Soloveitchik. We're not going to look at it now because it's 1 o'clock and my time is up. But you could read a little bit about, does Judaism value, is there a place for hatred in the Jewish tradition? And next time we will discuss medieval codifiers, how they viewed Christianity, and we'll focus on post-Holocaust, Hakamata Medina, Jewish Christian relations today. There's a lot to discuss. Yisher koach on the learning. Have a good day. Have a great week. Shavua tov.